including today. Send your gifts by faith to Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255. Shift your trust back to God, will you?
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Grismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Barbara Lowe Fisher with the Vaccine Information Center, and we're going to be talking about the effort to vaccinate the entire population because of the threat of the swine flu pandemic, this supposedly very virulent, dangerous new infection that's sweeping across the world and has killed, well, here in California, we're told it's probably killed close to 50 people, and that's a tragedy, probably throughout the world, by my calculation, somewhere less than 3,000 people, but I'm sure Barbara can bring us right up to date what the latest figures are. And yet, is this really such a terrible, terrible threat that we need to vaccinate everybody in the world? It seems to me a lot of the people have had the swine flu, a very mild infection, and it's passed. And what about the possible danger of another massive worldwide effort to vaccinate large numbers of people? We know that many of these efforts in the past have been a disaster. So with that as the background, let's get Barbara's thoughts on this. Good evening, Barbara. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Why don't you pick up the story and tell us what you think about this? Where do we stand with this pandemic? We're told this is a terrible thing, but is this really a pandemic that threatens civilization? This is almost the impression that we get hearing all of the propaganda being put out by the media. What are the real statistics? Where do we really stand with this?
Well, you know, it has really been so hyped since the swine flu virus, this bird-pig-human hybrid virus, appeared near a pig farm in Mexico in April. And by June 15th, there were about 35,000 cases in 76 countries, 163 deaths, 108 of those deaths occurred in Mexico. It looks as if we've got about 100,000 cases right now. The thing is that they're not doing anymore is they're advising doctors to not actually confirm the cases. They're saying, you know, there's about 1 million cases probably estimated around the world. We don't really need to lab confirm the cases anymore. This is going to be a growing problem because, you know, if you're not confirming, if you're assuming that everything you see out there that looks like flu is swine flu, you're not really going to know what the real situation is. So we're very concerned that they have decided that they're not going to confirm cases anymore and are actively advising that there not be confirmation anymore.
Well, now, how about all these deaths? Certainly, I read just an article today saying that there are 22 or 23 new deaths in California, bringing the number up to 50 deaths in California. But are these confirmed deaths or are these assumed deaths?
My understanding is when they have been giving out so far, up till now, until they just said to people, let's not confirm, or doctors, let's not confirm, so far the figures they're getting out is confirmed deaths and confirmed cases. But I think it's going to be very difficult to know with these figures anymore as to what is confirmed and what is not.
Do we have any idea how many cases in the world so far of deaths so far?
Well, it's my understanding that they're saying that there has been about a million cases that they estimate have occurred in the world. I think about 100,000 cases is what they've confirmed.
What about the deaths?
In almost every country. I believe there have been about 400 deaths that have been confirmed, but they're estimating that those deaths are much, there are many more.
Hold that thought. I'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess it's Barbara Lowe Fisher. And so basically 400 deaths, a tragedy. Every death is a tragedy. But when you stop and think of the number of people who die every single day from malaria, probably 2,000 or 3,000, and from AIDS, probably 4,000 to 6,000. I mean, 400 throughout the entire world is not the catastrophe we're being led to believe, is it?
Well, I think that, you know, when they estimate there are 35,000 or 36,000 deaths every year in this country, we know that is an exaggeration from the regular flu. We know that there is not confirmation. That's an estimation that there's 36,000 deaths that occur every year in this country from regular influenza. We think that they're often saying that that anyone who dies of a flu-like illness, that it's actually the flu. So we don't really know how many people actually die of type A or type B influenza in this country every year. But certainly, you know, the regular flu, apparently, kills more people than certainly we've seen with this swine flu so far. What they're saying is that this is just the first wave of in a pandemic. There are three waves. There's the first wave that's mild. There's a second wave that they're anticipating coming in the fall, which is why they say they're rushing these swine flu vaccines out on the market. And then there would be a third phase, if it is a true pandemic, which they say it is, in the spring, which could be milder or could be more severe. But usually if it follows a pandemic, it's usually the third wave is less severe because the population has dealt with it. There's been an adaptation and immunity among part of the population. So, but they're definitely going forward with rushing these new swine flu vaccines out on the market.
Well, now why? It should be very obvious to anybody who looks at this that there's just a lot of propaganda, just like they've used in the past. This is what they did when they sold the public the swine flu epidemic back in 1976. So what's really behind this? Why are they making such a big issue out of it? Is it somebody's going to make a lot of money out of this? Is there some other reason? Is this a diversion from what's going on in the world? What are your thoughts, or do we have any way of knowing why they're telling us it's such a terrible pandemic, when if you look at the number of people who've died compared with even the number that they say or they claim die every year, it's the United States is minuscule.
Well, I've been taking a look at the history of what's happened since September 11, 2001, in terms of federal legislation that was put in place in the past decade.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I was simply asking Barbara why we're seeing all of this propaganda about this terrible worldwide pandemic. And Barbara says that the confirmed cases are at the present time. What was the date you said there were 400 cases? What was the date of that?
That was a couple of days ago. I had checked it today.
All right, fine. A couple of days ago, about 400 confirmed cases throughout the world. And, of course, here in the United States, they've been telling us for years that 36,000 people die every year of the regular influenza, and yet 400 people die worldwide in this terrible pandemic. And we've got to do something, and we can't wait, and we're investing billions of dollars to create a new vaccine. And another $7 or $8 billion has been put aside just to give the vaccine here, I believe, in the United States. We know Great Britain's planning on a massive vaccine program. And I asked Barbara, why is this? I mean, is there some other agenda behind this? Does this have to do with a lot of money to be made by the vaccine companies? Does it have to do with diverting our attention from other things? I mean, we don't know, but the one thing I know, and I think Barbara would probably agree, is that this epidemic is being hyped. They're playing games with our minds. And the question is, why? So why don't you pick the story up?
I really think that if you look at the legislation that's been passed since September 11, 2001, the BioShield legislation, the Pandemic and All Hazards Preparedness Act of 2006, really all started with the Homeland Security Act of 2002, you will see that there was a tremendous amount of money and infrastructure that was put in place with these pieces of legislation, which greatly expanded the powers of the executive branch of the federal government and created the Department of Homeland Security and created an agency called BARDA, which was put under HHS and which formally created a partnership between federal health officials, federal agencies, and the pharmaceutical companies to produce new vaccines. At the time, they were justifying all of this money and these new agencies under the umbrella of bioterrorism, of combating bioterrorism. But what they threw in there was also natural disease outbreaks, pandemic influenza that potentially would crop up. Well, you know, they spent a lot of time and a lot of money creating these vaccines. And I think that they want to, and creating a pandemic flu plan. And I think that part of what we're seeing is they're taking an influenza, this swine flu influenza, which they are saying is going to, it could be deadly come fall, come next spring. But they don't, right now, it isn't deadly. It is mild. It has the same kinds of symptoms as the regular flu. Yes, as you point out, it has killed a few hundred people. It has caused sickness. But it is not certainly in the category of the kinds of virulent pandemics we've seen, that have caused far more deaths in the 1957 pandemic, the 1968 pandemic. So I think that it's an awful lot of hype when they don't really know whether or not it's justified creating all of these vaccines to give literally what their goal is to be able to have enough vaccine this fall and winter to give to every American. I know that they are starting out with trying to create 190 million doses, but their goal is that every American would be able to get this vaccine.
Well, this is going to be very, very profitable for the vaccine companies, but is it going to benefit the people? This is the question. Will the danger of the vaccination outweigh the possible risk of the, the possible benefit of the vaccination?
Well, I think that we're not. They did release some information today. They said that they are having difficulties with production. Right now, they are going to use the eggs, as they have with the traditional influenza vaccines that they've created. They are going to use eggs for both creation of a live virus vaccine that would be inhaled, spray, as well as a killed vaccine, an inactivated vaccine. Right now, the very first batches of vaccine will not contain novel adjuvants, which we are concerned that they're going to try to fast track. Although they are talking about, they're worried that these vaccines won't be very effective, and they're going to have to use in the second round of vaccines that they create later in the fall, in the winter, that they are going to have to use adjuvants.
Well, now, could you explain to our listeners what the adjuvants are? Because an awful lot of people don't understand that term, and yet that is key to any discussion of vaccinations.
Right. Well, adjuvants are put into vaccines to increase potency, to try to trick the body into creating more antibodies, having a stronger immune response. And most of the adjuvants that have been used, they're used in the inactivated vaccines, not in the live virus vaccine. But in the inactivated, there mostly have been aluminum-based, aluminum adjuvants. They're talking, though, about using oil-based adjuvants, a squalene-like adjuvant. There are two, MF59 and ASO3. Those adjuvants have been used in vaccines that are licensed in Europe, like Cervarix vaccine, which is the will be a competitor to Gardasil vaccine that is used in this country for HPV. And GlaxoSmithKline is asking the FDA to approve Cervarix vaccine, and I think their license is still pending, but that contains an oil-based adjuvant. So these oil-based adjuvants are very controversial because they've never been licensed in this country for good reason. They ramp up the immune system. They really, really cause a really strong response, antibody production. And, you know, for people who may be prone to atypical responses, inflammatory responses, unable to resolve, mount a proper inflammatory response and then resolve it, they could be in trouble with swine flu vaccines that contain these oil-based adjuvants. So we're watching it very closely. And the one thing is that the FDA doesn't need any more bad publicity. And they don't need to be rushing out these swine flu vaccines, particularly when right now this swine flu seems to be pretty moderate, not very deadly. They really need to be careful before they rush these vaccines out with novel adjuvants that could cause a lot of harm.
But we've seen the terrible damage that some of these vaccines have done. Certainly we saw this in the 1976 swine flu vaccine, which I think one person died of the swine flu, and a handful of people got the swine flu, but hundreds got Guillain-Barré disease, and
right.
I'm indefinite as to actually how many people actually died. What I've read was 25, although I've seen a 60-minute presentation with Mike Wallace where he talked about 300 had died. Do we have any idea who actually died in this totally unnecessary vaccine program? I think it was, 40 million people were vaccinated?
Yeah, they were. And, you know, I don't know the exact figure of the deaths. I do know that for many, many years, there were people who were suing the government, trying to get compensation for their injuries, most of them from this paralysis that's caused by Guillain-Barré. So I know that it was very controversial because you're right. There were far more people who were injured by the original swine flu vaccine back in 76 than there were that died from the, really, it was a non-existent epidemic. I mean, it never happened. And that it became quite a scandal for the Ford administration.
If I could just mention for our listeners, if you have a pen, write down a daily motion. That's daily motion. There's an excellent, a DVD. It's a 60-minute presentation from 1978 or 1979, probably 1979 with Mike Wallace. Somebody dug it up and put it up on the Internet. You can find it with a search engine. And just type in 60 minutes.
We actually have it on our website.
Oh, you do?
On the homepage of our website.
Well,
we did. We put it up because I thought it was such an amazing video. At www.nbic.org, if you go on our homepage, you'll see under news flashes, you'll see that 1976 60 Minutes video about the original swine flu scandal.
All right, now let's get your website up one more time, because that is such an important, your website's important anyway, but that is such an important program for every one of our listeners to watch. I mean, somebody sent it to me this morning, and I said, I don't have 20 minutes to spend watching a 60-minute program that was broadcast in 1979. I started playing that. I sat there the full 20 minutes. They showed the ads that were used. They showed the government officials who said, why, nobody told us that there was a problem, that there could be neurological problems. And then other government officials said, of course we told them. They knew exactly, you know, what was going to happen. We told them of the dangers, the very real dangers. Nobody told us, you know. And you knew these people were lying, and nobody was ever punished. And at least 25 people died. According to Mike Wallace, 300 people died. But so what is your website again? I want people to go there anyway.
It's www.nvic.org.
NVIC.org. That's National Vaccine Information Center, right?
Right.
Okay, fine. Well, go there, ladies and gentlemen. Watch that. And then get everybody you know to watch that 60-minute presentation. That's one of the most significant things I've seen in a long time.
Yeah.
It shows the propaganda that was used. And, boy, those were wonderful ads that they had there to convince you that if you didn't take that vaccine, why, you might become very sick and you might die. And a lot of people believed what they saw, and they took the vaccine, and they became very sick, and a number of them died or became paralyzed for life. We'll be back in just a moment with Barbara Lowe Fisher of the Vaccine Information Center. Go right ahead, Barbara. Anyway, I think that I'm so glad that you're running that 60-minute program. I think every American at this time, if we get every American to see that, they...
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four-tape or a four-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
They were talking about just using genetic parts of this to make it. And then they were talking about using attenuated virus. And then they were talking about using the killed virus. And I was simply asking Barbara, what do we know about this vaccine? Is it going to contain mercury? Is it going to contain adjuvants like squalene, which is totally experimental? It's created all sorts of problems, certainly in people in the past. Or is it going to contain the aluminum? Barbara was saying that she thought maybe they were going to use eggs. But time is running out. I mean, here we are. We're moving towards the middle of July. And they're supposed to start giving this thing in, September or October?
And that's the problem. They're running out of time. And I'm not there, obviously, at the FDA, but I bet you anything, from what we heard today, that there is probably an argument going on between those people who want to move forward with the new ways of producing influenza vaccines, the genetically engineered approach, and the use of these novel adjuvants, and people who are taking a more conservative approach that's saying, no, we have to stay with the eggs. We know that. It's an approved way of manufacturing influenza vaccines. If we're going to use an adjuvant, we need to use an aluminum adjuvant that has been approved, and we need to go conservative. I am sure that there is a disagreement going on. The companies have wanted to use the genetically engineered method, because it allows them to use less antigen, less of the it allows them to produce more. The same thing, if they added these novel adjuvants, they would be able to produce more vaccine, more doses of vaccine, without more quickly. So I hope that they go conservative, because it at least we have some experience with growing these influenza viruses in eggs, and we have experience with the aluminum adjuvants. That doesn't mean, say that influenza vaccines are totally safe, but I really worry about injecting children with an entirely new way of making influenza vaccines, the genetically engineered approach, plus have novel adjuvants that have never been tested in this country, and just take this vaccine and put it in children. I mean, that is a huge national experiment.
Well, but this really is using our children as guinea pigs, using the American people as guinea pigs, because this is a totally untried vaccine.
Well, it is, and even if you go ahead and use the regular eggs, and they use, say, an aluminum adjuvant for the inactivated vaccine, they're still using a virus, a hybrid, a pig, bird, human hybrid virus that has never been injected into humans before. I mean, when you are exposed naturally to an influenza virus, the way, you catch the swine flu, and I've known people who have gotten it, and it is not right now any more serious than the regular flu. If you get it the natural way, you not only develop permanent antibodies to those strains, but you are potentially not going to have a kind of reaction that you would if it was injected into you, even in a lab-altered form, which it will be in lab-altered form. But, I mean, I just don't understand why they're getting so adamant about having to give everybody a vaccine rather than letting the virus adapt in the human population, in our population. Those people who get the swine flu have antibodies. That gives them a protection. That then makes them also a barrier to other people around them getting it. They're naturally immune. And that's how most viruses and viral and bacterial diseases become less and less virulent over time. The population adapts, gets qualitatively superior immunity, cell-mediated immunity, and is able to then, move on.
Well, I think that the listeners really understand that there are several ways of harnessing the immune system. One is the natural way, and then the other is the artificial way. And doesn't this take an entirely different route? And I've forgotten my immunology. You know it probably better than I do, but there's B-cell immunity and T-cell immunity. Could you talk about that?
Sure. Will we come back?
All right, fine. Well, Barbara LoFisher, of course, is with the Vaccine Information Center. Incidentally, Barbara's putting on a conference in October, early part of October, which we'll want to talk about when we get back. It's important you and more people out there across America learn the truth and help us get the truth out. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were just talking about the different types of immunity, the B-cell immunity, T-cell immunity. I've forgotten more than I ever knew about that. What's the difference in one you certainly get through the normal means, the other way you get through the artificial stimulation the immune system means, and what's the difference as far as that is concerned, as far as your response to infection and autoimmune disease, allergies, and asthma?
Well, I'll try to make it simple because it is kind of simple, really. You have innate immunity, and you have learned immunity. Innate is cellular immunity, and learned immunity is what they call humoral immunity. When the body is presented with a challenge, either from a natural infection, a virus or bacteria, or vaccines, with a disease, the very first thing the body does is mount a cell-mediated, an innate immunity response. And then that produces inflammation, and if the immune system is working properly, there are anti-inflammatory responses that try to heal the body and produce antibodies. That's the humoral response. When antibodies are produced, that is the humoral or learned response. Those antibodies then protect you from future infection. With vaccines, the vaccines bypass the cellular or innate immune response. They only stimulate humoral, the learned antibody response. So it is not really the same. The vaccines do not work the same as when you're exposed to the natural disease. The immune system, only one part of the immune system is stimulated so that antibodies are produced. Well, you know, when you try to fool Mother Nature, well, what's going to happen? Usually what happens is you have a qualitatively inferior immunity. Vaccines only give you a temporary immunity where most of the time when you get the disease, you have a permanent immunity. So we have definitely skewed the immune response by giving children so many vaccines in early life, particularly in the book that I wrote in 2008, Vaccines, Autism, and Chronic Inflammation, The New Epidemic. I talk about the fact that if you already have, say, a history of autoimmunity in your family, a history of severe allergies, already indication that your immune system is unable to both...
Hold that thought. Okay. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Barbara LoFisher, and we're going to get back to the subject in just a minute. Really, the difference, there are two types of immunity. One is you get the immunity you have when you get an infection. The other is the type of immunity, which is a secondary immunity that you get when they give you a vaccine, creates an artificial response, and certainly if you have a normal infection, you have immunity for life. If you have this secondary, artificially created immunity, why, it's only temporary, and you can get the disease down the not too far down the line. So it's not an immunity for life. But, of course, what you've done, you've altered the immune system, and Barbara was simply pointing out that there are many, many people, especially if they have some sort of a family history of an altered immune system, that you give them vaccines, you're going to begin creating what autoimmune disease and allergies. Is that true?
What will happen, you would be biologically, genetically vulnerable to what I call getting stuck on inflammation. Because what happens is when you get repeatedly vaccinated, when you're repeatedly injected with vaccines, your immune system is constantly being atypically manipulated. And you can become chronically inflamed and in different parts of the body, depending upon your genetic predisposition. It's not that you're genetically predisposed to being learning disabled or having ADD or autism or having rheumatoid arthritis or diabetes. It is that you have encountered, when it comes to vaccination, an atypical manipulation of the immune system that has triggered an atypical inflammatory response. And so you become chronically inflamed. And, you know, here we are. We're going to line up. We have now 1 in 6 child in this country learning disabled. We have 1 in 9 with asthma. 1 in 100 to 150 with autism. And autism is definitely looks as if a lot of it is immune-mediated neurological dysfunction. And we have 1 in 450 children diabetic. And, you know, we have a chronic disease and disability epidemic that is mostly about chronic inflammation that's unresolved. And here we line up all these children, and we not only give them an experimental swine flu vaccine, they're also saying they need to get a regular flu shot. So you give them 2 doses of experimental swine flu vaccine plus a regular flu shot, plus, goodness knows whatever they're going to do if they've got them in the schools, what other vaccines they could give them. This could be a prescription for disaster for a large number of children who already have problems with chronic inflammation.
Well, I share your concern, and certainly we want to get people thinking along this line, realizing, of course, that, for instance, if you go into the Amish communities where the children don't take the vaccines, they just don't see, you know, unless the child somehow or other was able to get vaccinated, but usually they're not. But among the children who are not vaccinated, you almost never see autism, and yet you will see it somewhere, well, probably 1 in 100 boys, because the disease has a predilection for boys. 1 in every 100 boys in America today, young children, they've destroyed their lives because they're autistic, and you don't see it in children who don't take vaccines. Why doesn't anybody ever bring that out, Barbara?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I have been coming across some papers that were written, in the medical literature 5 or 6 years ago, where they were talking about the fact they don't have background data on unvaccinated children now, that they can't really do a comparison to look at health outcomes in unvaccinated versus vaccinated children. And so they don't really know, if you don't have a background rate on how frequently seizure disorders and asthma and diabetes and autism and learning disabilities and all these things occur in an unvaccinated child population, you don't have any handle, really, on whether or not the use of all these vaccines is causing chronic disease and disability in our children. You don't have a way to epidemiologically really get a handle on it.
Well, they keep insisting that these things are safe, yet they cannot tell you what causes the autism. They cannot tell you why so many of our children have neurodevelopmental abnormalities, why 1 in 9 of our children has asthma, and so many of them have allergies and these autoimmune diseases and juvenile diabetes. Juvenile diabetes has to do with something that has primed the immune system so that immune cells, you know, actually attack the islets of Langerhans in the pancreas, and this child, his pancreas is wiped out, and if they could only figure some way to block the immune cells, why we could treat the juvenile diabetes. Nobody ever says, well, why don't we ask why we have this immune response? I mean, what's causing the immune response? Anyway.
There's so much autoimmune disease now among children that we never had before. children with rheumatoid arthritis.
But, of course, all they have to do is look at the Amish children to find out. I don't think they want to look at the Amish children because there are papers out there, reports, that the Amish children don't have the autism that the regular children do. But before we go on, I do want you to, first of all, tell our listeners about this program you're going to be having back there in October, and then, of course, tell them why they should go to the vaccine information website.
Well, yes, we're having a wonderful, the 4th International Public Conference on Vaccination, October 2 through 4, 2009, in the Washington, D.C. area, near Dulles Airport at the beautiful Hyatt Regency Hotel. We have an incredible lineup of speakers coming from all over the world. We have, George Annas, who is an eminent bioethicist who's going to make a major statement about the right, the human right to informed consent to vaccination, even during a times of emergency. Diane Harper, who is an authority on Gardasil vaccine and who caused a lot of controversy by standing up in 2007 and 8 and saying this vaccine should be voluntary, the girls should not be forced to get Gardasil vaccine. Tom Jefferson coming from Italy, who is an authority on influenza vaccines and the medical literature regarding the inefficacy, really, of influenza vaccines that are given every year.
Okay, wait a minute. What you're saying, inefficacy, that's just a big fancy medical word that says they don't work, and that's
right.
True. I mean, the influenza vaccines really don't work. They have the studies on that, and yet they insist everybody get their influenza shot every year, and they even sell them, at Walmart and all the local stores, go to the Safeway store, get your influenza vaccine, and the scientific studies show the inefficacy, and of course, a big fancy word, they just don't work. Go ahead.
Exactly. He really did. He's done wonderful analyses as an epidemiologist, and has pointed out that that influenza vaccines really don't work in the elderly or the young. So he's very funny as well. He's a great speaker. Bonnie Dunbar is coming from Kenya. She's an authority on, she's actually a vaccine researher and an authority on hepatitis B vaccine.
And I've talked to Bonnie many years ago before she left our country, and I will tell you, she told me when she spoke out against the hepatitis B vaccine, her life was threatened. And that was one.
Yes, she basically eventually moved from Baylor. She'd been at Baylor for 20 years, won many awards, NIH grants. She was really an eminent vaccine researcher. She was trying to come up with contraceptive vaccines for animals. She's an environmentalist in animal protection, as well as humans, a safe vaccine. And she just eventually moved to Kenya so she could continue her research and not be harassed. Shiv Chopra is a human rights activist and a whistleblower. He used to work for the Canadian Health Authority agencies as a drug and vaccine regulator. He's very, very interesting and quite outspoken. And Bob Sears and Lawrence Pilevsky are two pediatricians who are going to be debating the benefits and risks of vaccination. To vaccinate or not to vaccinate is the title of that debate. Joe Mercola and Gary Null, who are holistic healthcare pioneers, are going to be there talking about holistic health and wellness. And, of course, Andrew Wakefield, who has caused a lot of controversy about the measles vaccine, and he's going to be talking about inflammation and vaccines.
Chris, he was literally driven out of Great Britain because of his work on the MMR vaccine, and of course, he was a gastroenterologist. He found out that a lot of these children with autism had chronic colitis, and when he scoped them, he found out that they had their measles vaccine was alive and well in their guts, and of course, he was literally forced to leave Great Britain, come to the United States. You were not allowed in the medical profession to tell the truth. He's a very courageous man.
A very courageous man. He came and spoke at our first conference in 1997. He's been at all of our conferences. We've had four in the last decade. And I will always stand by Andrew Wakefield. I know him to be a man of integrity, and I believe history will prove him right. But he has been made a horrible example by the medical profession on both sides of the Atlantic of what happens when you stand up and speak out about vaccine risks. That's really all that the demonization that Andrew Wakefield has been about. And I knew a long time ago that they were going after him because he was right. He was right scientifically. And I do think that will be shown maybe, I don't know if it'll be in our lifetime, but I do think that eventually he will be vindicated. We have Peggy O'Meara, who is the editor of Mothering Magazine, and Jane Bryant is coming from the UK to talk about freedom of the press in discussing these issues. And I have constitutional lawyers who are going to talk about health freedom in this country, the legal rights that we have and are losing quickly. A lot of doctors who are talking about holistic health, chiropractic, naturopathic, homeopathic. I have a really interesting doctor of veterinary medicine, and also he's a microbiologist, Richard Pitcairn, who's written a couple of books on holistic health for pets. And he knows quite a lot about vaccines and pet vaccines and is going to be talking about that. So in the evenings, we're going to have advocacy training sessions for families who want to go back to their states and work in their states to protect the right to vaccine exemptions, because those exemptions are under attack right now. There are doctors and government officials who want to eliminate the religious and philosophical or conscientious belief exemption, leaving only the medical exemption to vaccination, which is extremely difficult to get now, since the contraindications the reasons for not getting a vaccine, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Centers for Disease Control, have been narrowed so that almost nobody qualifies for a medical exemption.
Well, I would think anybody who's seen this this 60-minute program you have posted on your website would say that there are lots of reasons not to get vaccines. One is the fact that government officials lie, and they came up with a propaganda campaign, and they ruined the lives of really hundreds and hundreds of people, if not thousands of people. And then, of course, a number of them died, and that's even ruining their life more. And nobody was ever held responsible. And the government, which pushed the program, said, well, it wasn't our fault at all. We had no idea what was going to happen. And then, of course, you see the government officials saying, of course they knew what was going to happen. We told them what was going to happen.
Yes. Well, indeed. I think that, you know, you only have to do a little bit of research on the subject of vaccination to realize that this controversy of vaccine safety has been around a long time. In this country, it's been around since the early 1980s. And, I'm part of that old vanguard of those young parents in the early 80s that started talking about vaccine risks. And at the time, we were talking about DPT vaccine, which is the vaccine that injured my son when he was only 2 1/2 back in 1980. But, you know, I knew that when I was researching with Harris Coulter the book DPT, A Shot in the Dark, which was published in 1985, I knew that it wasn't just DPT. We concentrated on pertussis vaccine, DPT vaccine in that book, but what we really did was critique the mass vaccination system and what was wrong with it. And sadly, when you read that book today, it is as true today, what we said in that book today, as it was back in 1985, because literally nothing has been done to really reform the mass vaccination system. It's only gotten worse in the last 28 years. And it breaks my heart because, you know, the government has inappropriately allowed the pharmaceutical industry to have way, way too much influence and clout in the federal agencies that regulate and make policy for vaccines in this country. And so, you know, in the last 3 decades, I've seen a tripling of the numbers of doses of vaccines that we're giving our children. As the public awareness grows about vaccines and the fact that they carry significant risks, we've seen just more and more vaccines be added to the mandatory schedule of vaccines. Why? Because there's this, what I call an unholy alliance between the federal agencies and the pharmaceutical companies.
I have no question at all. In fact, we carry a book by Dr. Marshall Angel, formerly the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, on the staff at Harvard. She was, who, of course, was so harassed. She wrote a book called What You Should Know About the Drug Companies. We do carry the book, What You Should Know About the Drug Companies. And she was so harassed, they tracked her. I mean, I debated somebody from the pharmaceutical industry. They knew every television and radio program she appeared on, and of course she was so badly harassed she wouldn't even answer her emails or do any radio programs. They target people who tell the truth. I'm amazed that you're still around, Barbara.
Well, you know, I've taken, NBIC has taken a resolutely pro-informed consent position. We've never been taken an anti-vaccine position, nor a pro-vaccine position. We have taken the position that we, as American citizens, have the right to be fully informed about the benefits and risks of vaccination and be able to make a voluntary decision. And that position, I think, is ethically a very strong one. And I think it's intellectually a very strong one, because we don't tell people what to do. We simply say empower yourself with information and make your own decision. And that, to me, is a very logical and a very important right to have with any pharmaceutical product.
And I think that people, if they were told that there were very real risks from the vaccine, they were told that there was a risk of death or of being chronically crippled, and then they were told the benefits, you might very well, a handful of people are going to die throughout the world from this this illness, but of course probably many more will die from the vaccine. Well, do you want to get your shot? And I wonder how many people would volunteer for it. I think people have a right to know, and they are not giving them an honest, informed consent, and you will have no comeback. And the vaccine companies don't believe in their vaccines because they got legislation passed that says that no matter what they do, why, of course, you can't sue them.
Well, and, you know, they lobbied very hard in the 1980s for protection from liability. They told the Congress, I was there. They said, you either give us liability protection or we're leaving this country without any vaccine.
Would you go to a doctor who said, you know, you give me protection or I won't take care of your, I won't take care of you. You sign this form and no matter what I do, why you won't sign. Would you really go to that doctor when you had other alternatives?
Well, you know, a lot of parents are being given that ultimatum. You either take these vaccines or get out of my office.
Well, I'll tell you what, if somebody's doctor says that to you, you get out of that office because he's not an honest individual. And he's not going to sign a form that said he'll be responsible to take care of your crippled child the rest of their lives. He's not going to sign that, but he wants you to. We'll be right back. Barbara, why don't you go right ahead?
Well, you know, I think that we do need to reform this mass vaccination system, and we do need to make sure that we have legal protections in the states to be able to make vaccine choices.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your two-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
In these times of falling values, high unemployment, loss of income, and with hyperinflation on its way, we have created a one-ounce silver coin with a cross and the words of John 3:16 on one side and the American Eagle on the other. These coins are mural finished, 0.999 silver. Each of these beautiful coins will always have an earthly store of value, plus the cross with John 3:16 as an eternal value. Go to www.john316coin.com and call 1-877-316-COIN while supplies last. Order these beautiful 1-ounce John 316 American Eagle coins today by going to john316coin.com and calling 1-877-316-COIN.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-.
Compensated, and the parents can be compensated for the destroyed lives of the children and the destroyed lives of the people in the family. And we, of course, the government will be sure that the people are compensated. And as Barbara points out, it's become a cruel joke, because, of course, they do everything they can to prevent compensation of these children whose lives are destroyed. Barbara is a very courageous lady. Of course, she has her book, A Shot in the Dark, another book. And we are going to carry the other book. I think I didn't realize she'd written a second one, but if Barbara wrote it, it's got to be good. Well, we have a four-tape set on vaccinations. We have a four-tape set on, a four-CD set on Vaccine Update 2009. You remember that Barbara was talking about how the vaccines create inflammation in the body. Well, of course, they also create, through a separate immune system, inflammation of the brain. And that's why you need to see Dr. Russell Blaylock's excellent DVD, Vaccines and Brain Development. That's Vaccines and Brain Development. We carry a couple of the DVDs put out by Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and we carry Dr. Sherry Tenpenny's book on vaccines. We carry actually three books by Neil Miller, Vaccines, Are They Safe and Effective? Autism, and of course, basically, you're just going to read the congressional hearings on autism, totally suppressed by the controlled media. They can't let the American people know that they're destroying the lives of children. So there are three books by Neil Miller: Vaccines, Are They Safe and Effective? Autism, and the Vaccine Safety Manual, with a foreword written by Dr. Russ Blaylock. They're all available from Radio Liberty, along with Dr. Blaylock's DVD, Vaccines and Brain Development, and certainly our two four-tape sets, Vaccine and the CD, four-CD set, Vaccine Update 2009. They're available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And then, Sydney, you can go to our website, radioliberty.com, and Sydney, you look at all the books and videos and four tape sets we have, and we may have some that I just couldn't come to mind at this time. But you need to understand that this is simply one of the many attacks on our children today. You need to understand that they're poisoning our children with aspartame. They know it is a poison. It produces pathological obesity. Have you ever noticed they talk about the dangers of obesity, and they blame the McDonald's, they blame the Colonel? They never tell you that they knew that aspartame produced pathological obesity before they released it. They suppressed it. They kept it out of our food for 15 or 20 years. And then, of course, because of Donald Rumsfeld and the Reagan transition team in 1981, they introduced this, and of course, it's done immeasurable harm. It's a carcinogen. It is known to produce brain tumors in animals on a regular basis. It's known to affect fertility. It's known to affect the mind. And, of course, they're putting this in our food. We have some excellent DVDs on aspartame. We have four-tape set on aspartame. You need to get the information from Radio Liberty. And then, of course, we carry a book on aspartame. Cindy, it's called Excitotoxins, a Taste That Kills by Dr. Blaylock. We have material on mercury, and they're poisoning our children with mercury. We have information on water fluoridation, and they know, of course, that is carcinogenic. They know that it affects the mind. I mean, what do you think the active ingredient in Prozac and Luvox is? Why, it's fluoride. But then that's another story for another night. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, radioliberty.com. We're involved in a spiritual battle, and behind everything going on are powerful forces of evil. If you haven't read Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. Brotherhood of Darkness, then please pray for America, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views I've expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Mr. William Grieg, former senior editor of the New American Magazine, and now, of course, writing blogs, has his own radio program, writes books. We carry his latest book, Liberty and Eclipse. And if you haven't read it, it is available through my ministry. That's Liberty and Eclipse by William Grieg. But certainly we're going to be talking this evening really about what the things, the latest issues. One thing I do want to mention before we get to William is something happened this week. And this was that an organization known as CIT, C-I-T Financial, is thinking about filing for bankruptcy. Now, basically, this is a financial institution that provides loans between $950,000 and $1 million to small businesses and enterprises across America. They provide the funding that these companies need. Almost 1 million American businesses and enterprises and factories and manufacturers, and they get their money from CIT. And CIT may very well file for bankruptcy this weekend or next weekend. The Obama administration has refused to give them any funds, and of course somebody has put word out to pull their money out of CIT. They're doing with CIT just exactly what they did with Bear Stearns to bring it down in March of 2008. They're doing this. But CIT, of course, is much more vital to the function of our society. And the Obama administration has decided not to help it. They've already gotten $2.3 billion from out of the TARP funds, and they could probably stabilize them with another few billion. But they're not going to do that. They're letting it going to go down. And they're betting it's not going to have an impact on our society. Ladies and gentlemen, if CIT goes down and 1 million small businesses and enterprises and manufacturers can't borrow money to stay in business, what impact do you think that'll have on our society over the coming months? And I think you'll know whether I'm correct or not here in the next week or two, because if they let SIT go down, it'll pull down the whole financial structure, and they're doing it intentionally. They know what they're doing. They just don't want you to know. They want you to think they're trying to stop the cascade and home foreclosures. They want you to think that they're trying to stop closing down of General Motors factories and shifting production overseas. They want you to think that they're really trying to prevent the destruction of our economy. Exactly the opposite is the case, because only out of chaos comes change. They know what they're doing. The banks have done this repeatedly, as we demonstrate in our talks and some many of the books we carry. And you need to find out what's going on and prepare for the very difficult times that lie ahead. And without further ado, William Grigg, thanks very much for being with us, William.
Dr. Stan, thank you for having me on again. It's always a pleasure.
And what are we going to talk about tonight?
I think we should elaborate just a little bit on the scenario you were discussing here. If you pull the finance support from small businesses, if you cannot, for instance, as a trucker or some other business involved in transporting consumer goods, particularly when you're talking about the supply of grocery stores with food at a retail level, if you can't go out and get short-term credit, what happens is that the consumer economy seizes up, and you end up with a situation where you have localized and very intense shortages of fundamental, irreplaceable consumer items. And that's one of the reasons why otherwise sober and very sedate people like Peter Schiff and Gerald Celente have been talking about the possibility of food riots this year in the United States, most likely around the end of the summer or perhaps even in early fall. That's a very acute possibility. It might happen a little bit later than that. God willing, we'll be spared any of that. But if you end up removing the fundamental lubricant of short-term credit, that's stuff that has to be paid off very quickly. We're not talking about debt that is carried for a long, long time. We're talking about the honestly provided and expeditiously paid off short-term credit, which is used by people to carry out the very essentials of a dispersed consumer economy. And if that dries up, and if it's permitted to dry up, what you're talking about is a recipe for disintegration and social upheaval, the likes of which we've not seen in 7 or 8 decades, if ever, here in the United States.
And the thing is that, of course, the people who are behind this, and believe it's not Barack Obama, he's simply a tool of the power elite. The people who are behind him know exactly what they're doing. And this fascinating article in the Wall Street Journal said the Obama administration is betting that if they let SIT go down and lose, of course, the funding for 1 million businesses and small enterprises, that it won't pull down the economy. They're betting it won't. You would think that there is even the possibility that it would. They would do everything they could to prevent it, and they're going to let it happen. They know, ladies and gentlemen, what you must understand is these people are not stupid. This is not a mistake. They're going to tell us, oh, shucks, we had no idea what was going to happen. They know exactly what's going to happen. Go right ahead, William.
We've talked about the fact that last fall, in September of last year, under the pressure of these apocalyptic predictions by the likes of Hank Paulson, that if they didn't get the TARP mechanism in place, we would see widespread and perhaps Armageddon-like social upheaval in the United States. They passed this TARP measure. It failed the first time. They came back just a few days later. They expanded it. They enriched it with all kinds of artificial sweeteners and inducements in the form of perquisites and pork to be ladled out in classic fashion by the congressmen whose votes they coveted. But we saw how they literally, that is to say, the people behind the scenes, Hank Paulson, the people behind him, used the threat of complete social breakdown to get this passed, and literally the threat of martial law. And the thing is, there's no way that this would have happened last year if you would have allowed these financial houses to go out of business. There would have been dislocations in the economy, certainly. But the people who would have been hurt by this would have been people of the entrenched power elite, the financial people who are plugged into the system and who have made money off of arbitrage rather than by actually producing things that people need. Now we've got a situation where the very essentials the nuts and bolts of the consumer economy are...
Hold that thought, William. We'll be back here in just a moment with our rest of our audience. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly William was just saying that last year they passed the TARP legislation, the so-called Troubled Asset Relief Program, which was to be used to stop the cascade of home foreclosures. Instead of that, of course, they gave it to the wealthiest banks in this country, people who did not need it, who did not want it, and they used that instead of trying to stop the cascade of home foreclosures, because if they'd done that, the whole phenomenon, this whole economic collapse would have ended. But right now, of course, what we are facing at this time is cutting off the loans to 1,950,000 to 1 million small enterprises, and we're talking about coming within the next couple of weeks, whereby the Obama administration refuses, absolutely refuses, to give any money to SIT. And of course, somebody's put the word out so that everybody's pulling their money out of this company. They can't borrow money anyplace. They're conspiring to collapse the major lender to small businesses in America. Why would you do that unless you wanted to destroy our economy? Pick the story up.
That is to say, if you want to destroy the middle class element of the economy and hollow it out in such a fashion that you end up with a classic feudalist dichotomy between the politically protected super rich and then the politically imprisoned poor. And what they're creating, of course, is a dynamic where they would literally suck the marrow out of the body politic by destroying the financial support for the commercial middle class, the bourgeoisie. This is very much a part of the classic approach to creating a communist society. In a communist society, we're told that there would be no classes at all, but there, of course, are classes. There is a hierarchical structure. Society is striated in such a way that you have the vanguard, the nomenclatura, the ruling oligarchy, which is built around the tiny entrenched elite that controls the means of coercion, and then beyond them, of course, you have a support structure of sycophants and toadies and errand boys and so forth. And then you have, within the larger society, the military apparatus and the apparatus of surveillance and regimentation. And then you have those who are supposed to be productive class, and there's no incentive for the productive class to produce. The old joke was that in Russia, Soviet Russia, the workers pretended to work and the government pretended to pay them, because there was no incentive for somebody to go out and produce, because he didn't really own anything. Everything was owned by those corporatives that were operated by parts of the elite that were attached to the ruling structure. And this was being done supposedly as a transitional phase. At some point, the scaffolding would fall away and the state would wither away, and you'd end up with a classless society, because the human nature of the occupants of this society would be changed in such a way that they would no longer be acquisitive, that they'd no longer be motivated by the need to acquire and improve one's lot materially. You'd be satisfied with whatever you were given in the name of the collective interest. But part of this, of course, has to do with the concentrated focus assault on the middle class. And this really strikes me as a perfect illustration of how this can happen in the context of American society. Good grief, if you take a look at the rate at which things are becoming nationalized in the American economy, whether you're talking about the insurance company, the insurance system through AIG, which of course is now nationalized. We bought that. It's completely worthless. That's something which came out just in the last week or so, confirming something I had written as long ago as I think last October or September, that AIG was fundamentally worthless, that it was a completely fraudulent enterprise. Or whether you're talking about the automobile industry, and Obama is demanding a forced draft rush, like a two-minute drill in football, to pass the outright nationalization of the health care system, which, of course, is about one-sixth of the economy and a growing sector of the economy on account of the demographics of the aging baby boomer cohort. And if you take a look at what's going on, particularly in the realm of socialized medicine, which is what we're discussing here, it's really quite terrifying, because the legislation for the socialized medical system that Obama and his kindred are pushing, his kindred spirits, it literally would make it a crime for people to go out and acquire private health care insurance. They want to collectivize the entire system. They want to penalize those who don't have insurance, and they want to penalize those who have private insurance. And so they want to force us all into one great collective with the central government deciding what we should receive by way of health care.
I think what's even more amazing about this is here we are in a recession. We're in a terrible recession, and many of our small industries and small companies and manufacturers are having real financial problems producing things and making money, and yet they're going to take and add an 8% surcharge on every employer who does not provide health care coverage. Now, right now, the employer is paying 7.5% of the salary in addition to the salary to the government, then they're going to charge another 8%. That will be the surcharge for health care. Then, of course, if he's making over $350,000 a year, they're going to charge him another 3 or 4 or 5%. You know, because of course he's got to contribute more to the so we can finance this health care system. I mean, what they're going to do is put so many burdens on the manufacturers. A lot of them are just going to pick up and say sayonara.
Yeah, which is of course part of the same process of destroying the bourgeois middle class commercial economy of the United States. We don't really make anything anymore. The productive capacity of our country, in an industrial sense, as we have pointed out, has been demolished. Most of what's produced that we manufacture in this country is manufactured on behalf of foreign interests, which means that there is some productive capacity. It's just not something which is owned and operated by Americans anymore. You take a look at the fact that we've become really the hewers of wood and drawers of water for our creditors over in China in terms of exporting to China the raw materials that would be used in China to assemble finished consumer goods. So that's been destroyed. You're talking now about imposing health care surcharges on an already reeling economy here, people who are involved in whatever commerce and whatever productivity still occurs in this country. And then, of course, they just passed in the House of Representatives, they just passed this abhorrent so-called climate bill that amounts to a huge tax on energy, the assumption being that you'd have this cap-and-trade system of taxes so-called emissions permits. And the really weird thing about this is something you might have pointed out, Matt Taibbi, in his article in Rolling Stone magazine, went into the details of how this would put Goldman Sachs in the position of collecting taxes on behalf of the federal government, energy taxes, because they would be administering this cap-and-trade emissions control system. So you'd be penalizing, once again, those who are productive through the tax system, and then enriching Goldman Sachs, which is a fund which is fundamentally running the Treasury Department now. It's basically taken over the Treasury Department as part of this de facto triumvirate that is operating the economy. You know, the Treasury Department, Secretary of the Treasury, is basically the economic dictator of the country. The head of the Federal Reserve is in charge of monetary policy, and the President of the United States is in charge of the Army and the police, is how it works out. Those are the triumvirs of our new regime. And Goldman Sachs, of course, is making incredible amounts of money in this horrible economic downturn, which is basically wiping out the fundamental foundation of America's once free economy, and that's the middle class. And that, of course, would be all to the good from the revolutionary Marxist perspective. You want to wipe out the middle class. You want to destroy it, because it's the great impediment to social revolution.
Well, let me just point out for our listeners that Timothy Geithner is Secretary of the Treasury, but of course his right-hand man, the Chief of Staff, Timothy Geithner's Chief of Staff, is a man named Mark Patterson. Where did he come from? Why, he was a lobbyist for Goldman Sachs. And of course, what is the most important bank in the Federal Reserve System, the second part of the triumvirate? Why, that is the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And who is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York? Why, he came from Goldman Sachs, as did the man who preceded him. Does anybody think that is simply by accident? And of course, the CEO of Goldman Sachs just happens to be, just by chance, I mean, just a coincidence, a member of the Trilateral Commission. Of course, Paul Volcker belongs to that. Timothy Geithner belongs to that. James Jones, the National Security Advisor. James Jones, assistant to deputy in charge of national security, Mr. Dimelon, I think it is, Thomas Dimelon. Of course, Hillary's husband was a member of the Trial After Commission, and the ambassador of the United Nations, and right on down the line, of course, they all come from this same little clique that really runs our nation and, of course, works very closely with the people from Goldman Sachs who are part of this little club, only about 87 members of it, but they control our government and make mockery out of the so-called representative government.
It's interesting, and I know that you probably talked about this quite a bit. You very little elude your net, and you're very conscientious of letting your listeners know about these sorts of things, Dr. Stan, but that comment that Hillary Clinton made a couple of days ago at the Washington office of the Council on Foreign Relations is the sort of thing that deserves a lot more attention than it's gotten when she said, I have been often to the mothership in New York City when she was speaking at the Washington office of the CFR. Hillary, as the Secretary of State, said, I've been to the mothership in New York City, but it's good to have an outpost of the Council right here down the street from the State Department. We get a lot of advice from the council, so this will mean that I won't have as far to go to be told what we should be doing and how we should think about the future. Just frankly and candidly admitting the role of the CFR in defining government policy.
And of course, what most people don't understand is the Council on Foreign Relations was established in 1921 as a front organization for Cecil Rhodes Secret Society, and of course it's a front for a man named J.P. Morgan who was deeply involved in the occult. He was deeply involved in astrology, but don't take my word. You can find J.P. Morgan up on the internet, simply use your search engine and type in J.P. Morgan astrology. You'll find out that he was dedicated to astrology and the occult, and then of course the part about the CFR. Page 952 of Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. You've got to read that book. It's your guide to understand what's really going on behind the scenes today. Well, William, go right ahead.
If I remember correctly, Mr. Morgan and his associates were also deeply involved in the creation of the Federal Reserve System.
Oh, they certainly were.
And the Federal Reserve is under unprecedented attack right now, badly overdue, desperately needed, thoroughly welcome, and this is something that reflects the fact that there is a growing population in the United States of people who understand that the Federal Reserve really is the focus of evil in the modern world, that absent the influence of the Fed, our country would be more prosperous, much more independent, and that we'd probably have a vastly different world, because the Federal Reserve has been deeply implicated in every one of the terrible policy initiatives, starting with the involvement of the United States in the European War, World War I, that has redefined the role of the government of the United States in the world and in our domestic affairs. War has an effect of sucking all the power and resources of a society into the center. That's one of the reasons why rulers since time immemorial have always been contriving to get their subjects into wars of various kinds. And in order to get involved in wars and the type of internationalist foreign policy that World War I prefigured, it was necessary for the people who were arranging this transformation of our society and of our government to have a central bank with the ability to inflate the currency, because you really cannot maintain an imperial foreign policy if you have a hard currency. If you're dealing with a limited, finite, hard money economy, it limits the amount of adventurism that a government can embark upon, because they have to get taxes extracted directly out of the people in order to fund these initiatives. And people start to put up a bit of a fight when they see the costs of endless warfare abroad that have nothing to do with enhancing the freedom of people living here in the United States. So the Federal Reserve was created. It immediately began to debauch our currency, by inflating the money supply. Immediately began to arrange booms and busts. And now we've got a situation where, less than a century after its creation, the value of the currency has been almost destroyed. They've managed to debase it by 90%. And so we have this awareness now, as we're standing here literally at the either at or just over the precipice of a huge depression there's an awareness of what the Federal Reserve has done to our country, done to our currency, and done to the world. And so you have this measure before Congress, sponsored by Ron Paul, that would bring about an audit of the Federal Reserve so as to expose to daylight, daylight being the best disinfectant, all of the foul, feculent deeds that are being done by the Federal Reserve in terms of monetary creation, in terms of inflationary policies, and in terms of the payout of this, these huge amounts of inflated currency to preferred clientele, whether you're talking about these politically connected financials such as Goldman Sachs, whether you're talking about payouts to central banks overseas. And this is something, of course, the prospect of which has got the highest echelon of the Federal Reserve leadership quite worried. Ben Bernanke and then his right-hand man, I can't remember his first name, but his last name is Khan, it's appropriate for a con man, have both gone before the Congress and protested that there'd be something improper and catastrophic about undermining what is called the independence of the Fed. For independence, a more appropriate word would be impunity. Criminal impunity would be a much more appropriate expression. They benefit from opacity. People can't look inside and know what they're up to.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest here is William Grigg, and we're certainly talking about what's going on. And I believe the name was Fred Kahn,
yes,
the right-hand man. But as William was just saying, nobody really understands the Fed. Most people do not understand. This is not a government agency. It is a privately owned central bank. It was established to give us stability for a currency, which it has not done. It was established to give us stability as far as our economy, and you can see what a great job it's done. What we have done is transfer the control of our money to supply to a group of private banks who have their own agenda. And what people have missed, and the people who discuss this have missed, is that behind this, these central banks, not only in the United States but throughout the world, are powerful spiritual forces.
Yeah.
And their real goal is to bring about this one world government. And that's why at this time in history, they precipitated this economic crisis that is going to gut the very substance of our nation. So you pick up the story.
The thing that I find really interesting about what's going on right now is how the prospect of an audit of the Fed, if this measure were to pass, is really bringing out the unalloyed nastiness of these people you're talking about. Remember, last fall, when Congress was balking at the prospect of passing this legislation which created this new triumvirate, which permitted the politically connected to benefit from the TARP payouts and made it possible basically to strip mine our economy or just to siphon away what remains of the wealth of the economy and put it into the coffers of the people who created this financial crisis. That Hank Paulson and company were literally threatening the Congress with the prospect of widespread civic unrest and martial law. And, of course, this is something they can't arrange. These people are experts at fomenting that kind of problem. They are the past masters of it. That's something that's been going on now for the better part of a century or longer as a matter of official government policy. There are three-letter agencies in the employ of the federal government that do nothing but foment insurrections and mass movements and conduct targeted assassinations for the purpose of bringing down governments. There's no reason on earth why they couldn't be doing that here domestically. They have in their retinue all kinds of informants and provocateurs and nasty folks who can be deployed at a moment's notice to create incidents that will provide the pretext for the type of martial law clampdown that no doubt was being threatened last September. Now, we've got a situation where these people are now saying to Congress, don't you dare audit the Fed. And they're saying that if you audit the Fed, what's going to happen is that the credit rating of the United States will be destroyed. And of course, that stands to reason, because once we lay bare the fundamental corruption at the heart of the system, if we show how the whole thing's based on fraud, then the credit rating has to be lowered. It has to be changed to reflect the reality. But they're saying if you do this, basically we're going to have a financial collapse. It's going to bring about the destruction of what remains of the economy. And so they're trying to set up the critics of the Fed as scapegoats for the financial collapse that they're going to inflict upon us. I don't doubt for a second, I can't prove this, but I don't doubt for a second, that if indeed CIT Financial is pulled, if they have a controlled demolition of CIT Financial, they pull out that pillar of the economy, and down goes the commercial economy because people aren't able to get credit, short-term credit, in order to conduct the usual commerce that characterizes our economy. And suddenly we have food shortages and ensuing social unrest. That the next thing that will happen is that we'll be told that this is the work of those who have been sowing dissatisfaction and sowing suspicions about the good and noble work of the Federal Reserve in stabilizing our currency. I don't doubt for a second that's how that would play out if they choose to go that way. And another thing that's happening, this is something that was in the Wall Street Journal just a couple of days ago, is that you've got all these people who are part of the bought and paid for elements of academe, all the folks who've been through the London School of Economics or Cognate programs over here in the United States, who've been indoctrinated in the gospel of fiat currency and inflation, and who are high priests of the Keynesian priesthood. They've signed this petition for Fed independence that was sent to Congress and to the President, and what they say is the following: we urge Congress and the executive branch to reaffirm their support for and defend the independence of the Federal Reserve System as a foundation of U.S. economic stability. The thing is, what these people are afraid of, what would happen if their dealings were exposed to the light. You talk about them as the Brotherhood of Darkness. That's exactly what's going on. They're afraid of the exposure to the light. They're willing to do anything by way of retaliation for those who want to shine the light on their dark doings.
And one of them has to read Ed Griffin's book, The Priest from Jekyll Island, to find out that they kill people. They tried to kill Andrew Jackson. Certainly there's a great deal of evidence that they killed Abraham Lincoln. If you haven't read Galen Ross's book, The Elite Serial Killers, to know what really happened to Wilkes Booth, and of course remember Jack Kennedy, who wanted to print money, government to print money. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest, of course, is William Grigg. William, one of the things that I wanted to get your thoughts on, I'd heard that there's plenty of support for the legislation, or at least for the resolution, to audit the Fed in the House of Representatives, but somebody had put through some sort of a resolution in the Senate that effectively killed the legislation. Where do we stand on that? Is there any way that the Senate might go along with the House position so we really could get an audit of the Federal Reserve System?
I think that if it were to pass the House overwhelmingly, the pressure on the Senate would be considerable. I think that what's happening in the House is that you really have a snowball effect. It's really one of the more dramatic things that's happened. The House is supposed to be more responsive to public opinion. It was designed that way. It's designed to be more responsive, and it's also designed to be more accountable. And that's one of the reasons why, when you have these sort of authentically populist movements for some kind of overdue reform, they attain critical mass in the House very quickly, but the Senate often, of course, finds itself not as receptive because the Senate's easier to control, there being only 100 of them and most of them being exceptionally narcissistic and easy to corrupt. But I do think that if you end up with a situation where you have over 300 or even more members of the House of Representatives on both sides of the aisle pass this, or vote in favor of this legislation, if it passes by that prohibitive of a margin, that you might end up with a situation where it'll get unbottled in the Senate and get through. But bear in mind, once again, that what's going on right now is not merely your typical corruption in Washington, where people are being bribed and bought off and being schmoozed by people of influence. You no doubt have right now some really nasty, explicit threats being made about the sort of thing that would ensue if the Fed were actually exposed to daylight. I really think that these people would be willing to set the world on fire, you know, rather than allow that particular institution to come under critical scrutiny of the sort that could end up abolishing it. And I really think that right now that's being made very plain in conversations we're not privy to. We only found out about the type of high-stakes blackmail that was being played last September after the fact. As a matter of fact, in today's London Independent, there's a story. Paulson reveals U.S. concerns a breakdown in law and order. It says the Bush administration and Congress discussed the possibility of a breakdown in law and order and the logistics of feeding U.S. citizens if commerce and banking collapsed as a result of last autumn's financial panic. It was disclosed
yesterday. Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly William was just telling us that Henry Paulson had made at least as we quoted in a British paper, saying that there was a talk last fall of a very real concern with in the Bush administration how they were going to be able to feed the American people if the system collapsed. Was that the essence of what he said, and where can I get that article?
It's in today's Independent of London by Stephen Foley.
F-O-L-E-Y?
F-O-L-E-Y. And the headline is, Paulson reveals U.S. concerns of breakdown in law and order.
And that's the London Independent?
Yes. And then the second paragraph is where the real action begins. Making his first appearance on Capitol Hill since leaving office, the former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson said it was important at the time not to reveal the extent of officials' concerns for fear it would, quote, terrify the American people and lead to an even bigger problem. Mr. Paulson testified to the House Oversight Committee on the Bush administration's unpopular $700 billion bailout of Wall Street, which was triggered by the failure of Lehman Brothers last September. In the days that followed, a run on some of the safest investment vehicles in the financial markets threatened to make it impossible for people to have access to their savings. Paul Kanjarski, a Pennsylvania Democrat, asked Mr. Paulson to reveal the details of officials' concerns, which were relayed to Congress in hasty conference calls last year. The calls included discussion of law and order and whether it would be possible to feed the American people and for how long, according to Mr. Kanjarski. Quote, in a world where information can flow, money can move with the speed of light electronically, I looked at the ripple effect, and I looked at when the financial system fails, a whole country's economic system can fail, Mr. Paulson said. I believe we could have gone back to the sorts of situations we saw in the Depression. I try not to use hyperbole. It's impossible to prove now since it didn't happen. The Oversight Committee is investigating the takeover of Merrill Lynch by Bank of America, a deal forged in the desperate weekend that Lehman Brothers failed, and which later required government support because of Merrill's spiraling losses. Mr. Paulson defended putting pressure on Bank of America when it had last-minute doubts about the deal in December. Not to have done so could have rekindled the financial havoc the bailout had calmed. And that's the entire article. What the lawyers would call the gravamen of this is an admission by Paulson that, yes, there were discussions last fall about the prospect of a widespread breakdown in public order and the possibility of some kind of centralized, if you will, martial law type of a scenario, and justify the name of making sure that people got fed because of the financial crisis. Now, what this is described here as being is sort of a form of contingency planning or crisis management. But what was described as last fall, if you remember the video clips and the audio files that we discussed at the time, Dr. Stan, and I'm sure you recall many of your listeners will as well, it was described as a form of pressure, a form of blackmail. Do this or this will happen. If you do not pass TARP, then we are going to have riots in the streets, we're going to have food riots, we're going to have widespread civic unrest, we'll probably have martial law. And I don't doubt for a second that because of the growing demand on the part of the public, and it's reflected in the House of Representatives, that something be done to find out what the Federal Reserve is up to, that what's going on right now is that, among other things, in addition to the candid statements by Bernanke and Kahn and their like, that they don't want anybody to interfere with their so-called independence, and petitions being offered by members of the Keynesian priesthood in the academic realm, is that there's probably communication going on right now warning people that if the Fed is touched, the credit rating of the United States is going to be reduced from AAA to heavenly only knows what. That's going to trigger a crisis in the dollar, and that's going to bring about the collapse of the economy.
Well, you know, Chris, I think that there is a very real possibility if they let SIT financial go down that the economy will collapse. But I just assume that the Fed was in there and they took full responsibility, because this is exactly what they're doing. For a couple of billion dollars, they could have headed this whole thing off. They're intentionally not doing it. And what possible justification would there not be? I mean, they can give 12, or $1 billion or 25, I've forgotten how many billion dollars to J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs, but they couldn't give another couple of $1 billion to head off the collapse of the company that is providing loans to 1 million businesses? Come on now.
Yeah, I mean, people who actually make things.
Well, before we go on, I want you to get your blog site out. I want you to tell people about your radio program, and then we'll get back to this. But this is so vitally important.
It is.
I think the important thing for people to understand is the Fed is a privately owned bank. It is owned by people whose loyalty is not to America, but to this idea of a world government. And they are hell-bent upon the destruction of our economy. And what we need to do is expose them, and we've got the material. You've just got to learn about it and help us get it out. But why don't you tell our listeners how they can get to your material, how they can get to your books, how they can get to your radio program?
I appreciate that. My blog is called Pro Libertate, and it can be found by going to freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Freedom in Our Time is spelled as one word, freedominourtime.blogspot, blogspot.com. That's the easiest way to find it, or you can go to willgrigg.com and look at the right-hand side of the screen. There's a list of hyperlinks, and the one that would lead to Pro Libertate is right at the top of that list. That's at willgrigg.com. And at the end of every essay I publish on my blog, the essays are usually about 1,200 words in length, there's a thumbnail of the cover of the book Liberty and Eclipse, and you can go right next to that and click on a hyperlink that will take you to Amazon.com to buy the book. It's also available through Radio Liberty. And I now have a daily, weekly, that is to say weekday program on the Liberty News Radio Network, as it's called, Pro Libertate Radio, and that's at libertynewsradio.com, libertynewsradio.com. It's from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock Mountain Time, which is 4 to 5 o'clock Pacific or 6 to 7 o'clock Central Time, and it's available through the Internet, and the programs are archived as MP3s for those who want to listen to them later, if it's not convenient to listen to them at drive time when it's broadcast live. And it's also available in a small but growing number of terrestrial stations. The Liberty News Radio Network has been up and running for about a year or so. They have, I think, between 12 and 20 stations in California, some in the Rocky Mountain West. They have some in Utah. They have some in Texas. I believe they have some in Indiana, Kentucky, Florida. I've received phone calls from all across the United States. I've received emails from people who listen to the show from foreign countries. I got a really nice letter from Mexico not long ago from somebody who listens to the program on the Internet, which is a wonderful thing. I mean, talk radio as a free medium, when you're talking about people who are listening to it while they're working at their home or in their office or while they're driving or while they're jogging, that's a wonderful thing. But add to that the multiplier effect of both the Internet and shortwave, it's a remarkable medium, and I'm glad to see that it's still growing and prospering and thriving. I'm wondering how long we'll be permitted to do so, because it really is sort of like Samizdat in the old Soviet Union. That's the way that people got the real news out, around the officially controlled organs of opinion formation. But that's what we're doing with the Pro Libertate radio program on the Liberty News Radio Network. I'm really enjoying the opportunity to do a radio show. It's fascinating to deal with callers. It's a real pleasure to be able to take an hour and talk about things that I consider important or things that I merely consider interesting. And one of the things I've tried to do with the program, and I know this is something you've done as well, Dr. Stan, you were a pioneer in the medium, after all, is to expose people to literary sources and things that I consider literary treasures that they otherwise might not have heard of, whether you're talking about classical literature or historical literature, or things that have to do with exposing a lot of what's been going on by way of transforming our once free country, our once free society, into what it is now, and heaven help us what these people plan for us in the future. But it's wonderful to have direct access to people, to talk with them in real time about things that are matters of concern, mutual concern. And I'm impressed with the quality, the intelligence, and the eloquence of people I've had who've called into the program. And this is one of the not insignificant sources of optimism I have in terms of educating the public, is the fact that people do listen to radio shows about unpleasant but vital topics, and they can understand the importance of the things that are discussed, and they can make intelligent, timely decisions, and then they can learn these principles and learn how to express the principles and how to describe the problems and prescribe the solutions when they're dealing with other people. So I think that in as much as there's a possibility that we can do something about reconstituting our society on a sounder footing, that radio is going to play a very important part in that. And I'm glad at long last to have the opportunity to be part, in, albeit in a very minor way so far, but hopefully one that will grow in that element of the information and education revolution that radio is bringing about.
Well, I'm very glad that you're there, and certainly it's what we need is more people doing what you're doing and what I'm doing, and giving people an opportunity to become educated so that they can learn how to express these ideas to their friends, their family, because, of course, our job is to reach as many people as we possibly can in the time that God has allotted to us.
Yeah.
You ask how long this is going to go on? As long as God allows it. And believe me, He is in charge. Certainly the evil people may hold the reins of power here, but ultimately God's got to make the decisions. Well, let's get back. Of course, you were talking certainly about the Federal Reserve System. The fact that the Federal Reserve is frightened to death that the American people are going to learn who really owns the Federal Reserve. Nobody really knows exactly which banks own the stock in the Federal Reserve System, how much those banks make from their stock in the Federal Reserve System. There has never been an independent audit of the Federal Reserve System. And really, the beautiful thing is, as you listen to what Ben Bernanke says, and actually it's posted up on Alex Jones' website, he says now, he was asked about auditing the Congress, having the GAO audit the Fed, and he said, well, of course, audit, but then if Congress wants to, begin to interfere with the decisions and analyze our decisions, nobody had said anything about that. That's not what the audit is all about. It's an audit of the Federal Reserve System. So he adds on to that, then if Congress is going to interfere, then there's going to be a financial collapse.
Yeah.
He actually set up a straw man. Congress did not say they were going to take over control, although they certainly should. But the thing is that he brought up the subject. It was not in the legislation.
Yeah.
They are frightened to death that there will be an audit, and I think that there were, there would not be an awful lot of people who would go to jail.
Oh, certainly. And this is a really good illustration of the biblical principle that the wicked flee where no man pursueth. I mean, nobody had talked about the prospect that you would actually have Congress reasserting control over monetary policy or, quote, interfering with the functions of the Federal Reserve. We just want to know what's going on. You know, as you say, who are the member banks? How are they profiting off of this? You know, where is this money going? That sort of thing. And, of course, by way of responding to the prospect of that type of scrutiny, which is all, of course, that should be expected, any type of institution that exercises a fiduciary responsibility of any sort should be subject to an independent audit when it has that type of influence over public policy. That's just obvious.
I mean, it's sort of like Bernie Madoff. He had his own accountant audit his own books,
exactly.
Insisting that there was nothing to worry about. And then
exactly.
We find out that it's a gigantic Ponzi scheme. Suddenly, we could not trust Bernie Madoff to audit his own books, and certainly his books should have been open to the SEC, only they wouldn't look at them. But I think Congress has not only a right but an obligation to know what the Federal Reserve System is doing with its money and who really owns and makes the decisions for the Federal Reserve System, because certainly Ben Bernanke and the man who preceded him, Alan Greenspan and Paul Volcker and certainly Arthur Burns and William Miller, all of these have been controlled by somebody who's really controlling what's going on there. And the one thing they fear is the American people are going to learn the answer to that question. You go right ahead.
You brought up, once again, the case of Alan Greenspan, and you want to have a perfect illustration in the case of Alan Greenspan of the fact that somebody controls these people, because with Alan Greenspan, you had somebody who literally was flipped 180 degrees from the professed and very eloquently professed convictions of a lifetime when he was put in charge of the Federal Reserve. And when quizzed about those convictions by Ron Paul just a few years ago the convictions having to do with the need for a gold standard, the fact that you cannot have a welfare state, let alone a welfare warfare state, or a collectivist state, if you have a gold standard, and the fact that everybody who runs this system that is centered in the Federal Reserve is opposed to the gold standard for that reason. When Ron Paul asked him about that and asked him to autograph that famous essay, there was nothing that Greenspan disavowed. In other words, he understands the truth. He understands how things work, and he understands the nature of the scam he was involved in. But somebody controls him. There is some influence, some gravitational pull from an unseen object or an unseen entity that is so profound that it caused him to reorient himself 180 degrees while he was exercising power as, if you will, the commissar of the Federal Reserve, to the point where when he went before Congress just a matter of months ago, he, in defiance of his understanding and his convictions of a lifetime, tried to say that really it was the free market that was to blame, the unfettered free market, the ravages of untamed Wild West capitalism that brought about this financial collapse that was obviously a product of the Federal Reserve's engineered loose money, loose credit policies. You know, he knows better. And that's why he went to that conference of Gulf states in Saudi Arabia a year and a half ago and warned them that the dollar's value has been destroyed and warned them to get out of the dollar. He knows better than anybody else, being the chief architect of the dollar's decline in recent decades, that the dollar is worth nothing. And yet, for purposes of maintaining the facade here in the United States and preserving the institutional perquisites of the Federal Reserve, this guy will play this role slavishly. Who has the kind of power that could take somebody like Alan Greenspan and do that to him? You know, what kind of an organization is this?
Who are the people
behind the scenes?
Well, I think that if you read his book, The Age of Turbulence, you'll find that he talks about, of course, how he used to socialize with David Rockefeller and Henry Kissinger. It is not simply by coincidence that Alan Greenspan was a member of the Trilateral Commission, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, attended meetings of the Bilderbergers. He was the ultimate insider, an ultimate member of the Brotherhood of Darkness. And the fact that nobody ever mentions that, or certainly that between 1976 and 2008, three of the four chairmen of the Federal Reserve System just happened by accident, by chance, only by coincidence, to come from the membership roles of the Trilateral Commission. Do you honestly believe that? That six of the eight secretaries of state during that time came from the Trilateral Commission, eight of the ten, six of the eight presidents of the World Bank, eight of the ten U.S. World Trade Representatives, and certainly I think it was seven of the 12 secretaries of state and nine of the secretaries of defense. Do anybody think that happened by accident, that every president and or vice president during that period came from the membership roles of the Trilateral Commission? Well, could it possibly be the organization created by David Rockefeller does have an influence on our government? We'll be back in just a moment with William Greig. You've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program, William.
Dr. Stan, I had an interesting conversation just yesterday with a fellow who works for a bank. And he works at the bank where I have my family accounts. And he had called me because he wanted to get me involved in investing in certain instruments that I'm not interested in. But in the course of our conversation, it took us maybe a minute and a half for this individual to start talking to me in very grave tones about what's ahead for the economy. This is somebody who worked for one of the banks that was brought before Herr Paulson last fall and presented with an ultimatum. Basically, the government was going to buy in, and these people were forced to allow the government to buy in and cede control over their banks to the federal government. It's like something out of a gangster movie combined with something out of a banana republic. But the thing that I find really interesting is that this young man, he's only in his probably late 20s or early 30s or so, maybe not even quite that old, is aware of the fact that we're confronting the prospect of a complete meltdown in the financial system, a complete collapse of the dollar. He's aware of what the Federal Reserve represents. He's aware of the fact that the Federal Reserve has debauched our currency. But he can't talk about this professionally, obviously. He can't go out on a coffee break, and talk with people at his bank about what's going on, because he's got a job to do, and his job involves working as part of the system. Now, in his private off work hours, when he's not on the clock, he's very active in helping people understand what's going on. And I think that's the sort of thing that really explains both the potential crisis and the opportunity of the circumstances confronting us right now. It's because there are people like him, young people, professionals, who are principled and honest and hardworking, family people, who understand what's going on and are helping others through their social networks that they exist in to understand the real reasons behind our financial turbulence, that you hear all this talk about the possibility of a financial collapse, that you see the middle class being targeted right now for unprecedented financial terrorism, which is what the engineered collapse of Sitwood amount to, and where you hear people making threats, people in a position to bring those threats into existence, to consummate those threats, of civil unrest and martial law. And so we really are confronted now with a radical acceleration of this drive to consolidate power and a radical escalation in the amount of violence and the amount of subterfuge these people are willing to undertake in pursuit of their goals. So really the stakes are becoming clarified. That's a good thing. It's a terrifying thing, but it's always better, I think, to have a clear understanding what the enemy intends to do. That, of course, makes it easier for those of us who have been trying to bring people to an awareness of what's going on.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. Well, go ahead. William was just sort of wrapping up his thoughts here, but go right ahead. Once you finish your thought, and that'll let you go.
Yes, it is a wonderful but terrifying thing that our enemy is being candid now about what they intend to do and how they intend to do it. That's, of course, a luxury in a way, because we no longer have to bear the burden of convincing people about the malignity of their intentions when the malignity is on full display. So things are going to get nasty very, very quickly here, and people had better prepare.
I agree with you. God bless you. We'll look forward to talking to you next week.
God bless. Take
Thanks
care, Dr.
very much. Bye-bye. Well, I do hope our listeners have enjoyed our conversation with William Greig, and certainly he's going to be a guest at the October 25th Radio Liberty Conference, the annual conference. We're going to have Ashley Moat, member of the European Parliament. Tom Horn will be there talking about some of the crazy genetic things they're doing, animal-human hybrids and human-animal hybrids and all sorts of other things, and, of course, the spiritual significance of that. We're hoping, and we'll know by Monday for sure, that Catherine Albrecht will be here. And she, of course, as you know, PhD from Harvard, a regular guest on Radio Liberty, and, of course, she will certainly complete our list of outstanding speakers. And, of course, if you're interested in coming to the conference, we're expecting a sellout crowd. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we hope many of you out there will want to certainly go to our website, radioliberty.com, look at the four tapes or four CD sets we have, certainly look at the information we have on vaccines, the danger of vaccines, Dr. Blaylock's wonderful DVD, Vaccines and Brain Development, showing how the inflammation created by the vaccines impacts on the brain, why so many children will have epilepsy or have suddenly altered states of consciousness after their vaccines, and then, of course, why so many children will have permanent changes in their brain, the structure of their brain, because of the inflammation created by the vaccines, because that's what the vaccines are designed to do. And then, of course, you want to get our four tape set on vaccination, our four CDs update set on vaccine update 2009. You want to get our books of vaccines. Are they safe and effective? Vaccines of autism. The vaccine primer, and they're all available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That the last one's the Vaccine Safety Manual, the Vaccine Safety Manual by Neil Miller. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage is radioliberty.com, where you can listen to our programs on the Internet 9 hours a day and not get much of anything accomplished. You can listen 4 hours live. We do another program on the American Freedom Network from 7 to 8 every morning of the Pacific time. That's 8 to 9 in Colorado. But, of course, the information is there. And we need you to get educated so you can help us to educate others. Because behind everything going on are powerful spiritual forces. And unless you understand that they are real, they're not imaginary, that there really is another dimension, that there is a spiritual dimension to everything going on today, and that many of our leaders, in fact, the people in key positions, have given themselves over to the other dimension. If you doubt that, let me suggest my talk on the financial Armageddon. It will tell you who Barack Obama really is. Now, you want to get the talk. We do have a syllabus that goes with us, but the talk will give you the information that comes from people who are members of the Lucis Trust. They're Luciferians, and their view on Barack Hussein Obama and the preparations that have been made for years for his ascent into the presidency and who put him in the presidency. And the interlock between these ethereal and mystical groups and, of course, organizations like the Trilateral Commission. So we hope that you'll get the information, that you'll help us to disseminate it. You need my talk on the Brotherhood of Darkness, the Forbidden Secret, and the Financial Armageddon. And then please, please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. But pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection.